Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Right Side. I'm Andrea Ruth, and I am here, as always, with my co-host, Kimberly Ross. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic today, Andrea. How are you?
Good, good. It's just got my 10-year-old, it's so weird to say 10-year-old, back from her first week at a six-day sleepaway camp. So she's, you know, she's napping now. I think it's going to be a very quiet day for me. So
That's quite a big deal. You have the first sleepaway camp.
Yes. Yeah. Gone from her parents for six nights. So anyway, I'm sure all kinds of hijinks were had, but she had a great time. So, you know, we're into a we're into a new era. So, yes. But we do have a great guest on for this week.
Yes, we have a fantastic guest. I've been really excited to have him on. And we are welcoming Charlie Camosi, who is an associate professor at Fordham University in the Department of Bioethics, I believe. He is a staunch pro-lifer, and I mean staunch, and he's such a voice in the movement, a movement which I think is kind of, you know, polarized between people who present themselves as Republicans who are pro-life and conservatives, and then others who may not have a political home in either of the main parties who still are very vocal and active in the pro-life movement. So he's a great voice between the two. So Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having a non-conservative on the show. It shows, shows your open-mindedness.
Hey, we've actually done it once before, so I think we're okay with it. but again, thanks for coming on the show. And as I mentioned, you are, I think in another podcast, I listened to the Federalist podcast, and you presented yourself as an independent. However, you are very involved with Democrats for Life, and you were actually recently at the Democrats for Life conference. And one of, I think the number one question I have in my mind is kind of how do you present the pro-life position, particularly to Democrats who, when I think people like view the pro-life cause, they mostly think of Republicans or GOP. Obviously, that's not the case. Anyone, no matter what their political position is, can be pro-life and very vocal in that movement. So as someone who is an independent, how do you present the pro-life movement to Democrats who kind of generally seem to err on the side of the pro-choice side?
Yeah, so I identify, or I'm registered actually as an independent. I would be a Democrat, I think, if they had a different view on abortion. I just can't bring myself to be a formal member of a party that basically their platform says abortion is awesome. Not just pro-choice, but really pro-abortion in the true sense of the word. So one of the things we're trying to do at Democrats for Life is trying to bring back some of the diversity that used to exist within the party. So back in 2009, I don't know if you remember the debate over the Affordable Care Act, but there was a pro-life amendment offered by Bart Stupak, which basically said the Affordable Care Act wouldn't cover abortion. Mm-hmm. And 25% of the Democratic caucus in the House voted for that pro-life bill. Now, in 2010, they were all decimated by both right and left. And we can talk about more about why that happened if you'd like. It's pretty interesting and important. But the bottom line is we used to have a much more diverse party when it comes to this. And we would take on the arguments that our party would use on other issues. We would say, hey, guess what? It is government's job to protect the vulnerable from violence. And that's precisely what we're about as pro-lifers, presenting an unimaginably vulnerable population, prenatal children, from unimaginable and horrific violence. And to be honest, I hear too often from pro-choice Democrats, and no offense, ladies, but they sound like small government conservatives. You know, government, stay out of my life. No one should get between a woman and her doctor. Trust women. Stay out of our business, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's the way we try to talk about it, is it's government's job even to intrude on the liberty of even a substantial liberty interest of people to protect the most vulnerable.
Yeah, one thing when you were mentioning how they've kind of shied away from their previous mantra, which was safe, legal, and rare. And nowadays, definitely, especially when you're talking to people on social media, some say, well, no one is proud of their abortion. No one likes to talk about it. No one, you know, looks at it fondly and everything. And I don't know if you have, I've experienced quite the opposite with people talking about, I guess, the shout your abortion thing, and they'll wear dresses with the word abortion on it. And they're very proud of it. It's kind of like a badge of honor now. And that, not that it's ever been looked on as, well, not that the unborn life by people who are pro-choices have ever really been looked at as something that should be protected. But it seems now more than ever, they're less interested, you know, they're less interested to make it something that should be an option, but a rare option. And they're kind of looking at it as, I guess, a sacrament for their side. I don't know if you've noticed that as well.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but I would say I had a very similar experience that you have along these lines. We probably remember the hashtag shout your abortion thing that wasn't too long ago. That was a phenomenon. It comes from the fact that a genuinely pro-choice approach is in general a losing approach. So they could see that they were losing, especially with young people, you know, the appeal to autonomy, choice, and freedom. Well, in other contexts, young people are disproportionately skeptical of appealing to autonomy, choice, and freedom because the vulnerable get left behind by the powerful. So they've tried to double down on this and to say, well, it's a social good. In fact, Kristen Day, who's the executive director of Democrats for Life, and I did an op-ed in the LA Times a few months ago calling out the platform and in the Democratic platform. The Democratic platform actually says reproductive health, which includes access to safe and legal abortion, is, quote, core to women's, men's, and young people's health and well-being. Well, if abortion access is core to women's, men's, and young people's health and well-being, that's not rare. That's not something we want rare. That's something we want lots of, right? That's something we need. Mm-hmm. And that's a definite switch from the time in 2008, as recently as 2008, Hillary Clinton said, abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And by rare, I mean rare, mm-hmm. emphasizing the rare part. And 8 years later, and $30 million from Planned Parenthood later, she was singing a different tune.
But they kind of have to do that in a way, just because of the, and this was the first question that I kind of had for you, the way that people are kind of viewing abortion these days is more, it seems to be more on a scientific level rather than an appeal to, you know, a religious belief or even using the, you know, Fourth Amendment, which was what Roe was based on, that a woman has a right to choose. They have to kind of go to an exponentially hysterical, and you have this on both sides. I mean, I will say, like, I mean, you have the, you know, abortion, anti-abortion people with, you know, the signs of the, you know, pieces of babies and stuff like that. That's another, like, extreme. But what I was going to ask you was just kind of like how you came to, everybody kind of has their own, you know, way that they say, okay, I'm a pro-life person. But do you, going at it to, and presenting this to Democrats and proselytizing, I guess, pro-lifeism on to the Democrat side, so that's what I'm kind of wondering, do you appeal to the, you know, the we're the party of science aspect, or do you kind of bring up a, hey, we have, you know, on a philosophical level of, hey, we all have intrinsic inherent value that's not bestowed on us by government? I guess that's kind of like where I'm wondering, like, how you kind of bring this, do you present both issues? I mean, obviously, I hope so, but I was just kind of wondering how that came about.
No, it depends. No, it's a good question. It depends on the audience. So, mm-hmm. I guess overall and in general, I would say definitely both. But science doesn't get you values. That's what I try to teach all my freshmen in my faith and critical reasoning class at Fordham. Science is good. Science is essential, even, but it's not going to give you values. It only gives you data. So we could have the value that all Homo sapiens organisms, regardless of age, ability, dependence, race, gender, etc., are all equal in value, or all persons in equal in value. But science doesn't give you that. All science can do is tell you what's a Homo sapiens organism. And in fact, I'm not so sure we believe this anymore. I think, for instance, a functioning brain dead Homo sapiens, you know, which can gestate a fetus actually and can fight off infections and has homeostasis. Most people, I think, look at that brain dead Homo sapiens and say, I'm not so sure that's the same as all the rest of us. You probably know we abort somewhere between 70% and 90% of Homo sapiens that have Down syndrome in utero. Seems to say something about what we think about people with Down syndrome, even though they're happier than those of us without Down syndrome. So I'm not so sure we actually do, even if we agree on the science, agree on the value that all Homo sapiens organisms are equal and all are persons. if we did all agree on that, then it would be perfectly clear what we would say about the prenatal child, that they're a person the same as all of us. I mean, it's just no longer scientifically defensible to say anything else. We all know it now. We celebrate, you know, the very early 3D ultrasounds on all of our social media. You know, there's no, and we never say fetus bump. It's a baby bump, of course. A fetus isn't kicking. It's a baby that's kicking. So we all know this. It's just a question of whether they're going to apply it consistently. And that's what I try to push. Like, if you're going to deny that all Homo sapiens organisms are equal, then just be consistent about it. If you think that you need to be have a certain amount of intelligence, or you think you need to have a brain or a heart, you know, whatever these things are, just apply it consistently. It's inconsistency that annoys me more than anything, and it's a matter of profound injustice as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree. So when you are presenting, you know, I'm sure you get a lot of pushback from probably the Democratic Party. Kim, I think you kind of touched on this, just like your experience of it. But when you really get people engaged them in conversation, what's it like when you come at someone, or not come at someone, but get into a dialogue with someone that is, you know, very staunchly like my body, my choice, those kinds of things? Have you experienced someone like really turning their position around, or do they kind of like all of us have the kind of propensity to dig in, you know, and you know, kind of close our ears? So have you, I guess, on two spectrums, do you find a willingness to listen on to very pro-choice Democrats or even independents, or have you come across people that say like, wow, you really changed my mind? Is there basically hope? And I hope there is. I hope that's why you're doing this. But otherwise, why are you banging your head against the wall? but what is that like when you kind of have someone, you know, really reevaluate what their values are? And I'm sure you run across this in the classroom too, because Fordham's relatively very liberal, you know, private college.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I guess, is it punting to say it depends again? I mean, it depends, because it's the person. It's not the general sort of. So when I engage somebody, and I wrote a book called Beyond the Abortion Wars, where I explicitly say this book is for the middle 80%. If you're on the 10% extreme of either side of this debate, you're probably not going to like this book, and it's not for you. So I think we actually have to cut our losses. And I on social media, I try not to interact with people who are in the 10% extremes. And that's how I think it is in general. Now, in that middle 80%, there's still people who won't listen, but maybe who won't attack you or something. But my experience teaching undergraduates, and my undergraduates know what I think about this, but we deal with all the best arguments on multiple sides, is that my pro-choice students and my pro-life students, frankly, haven't really thought through these issues very carefully. They don't really know a whole lot about it. I just did a piece for the Federalist, which was something like seven reasons why it's misleading to say Americans support Roe versus Wade. And one of the most important reasons is Americans don't even really know what Roe versus Wade is or what it does. And I think the numbers are something like 40% of young people don't even know that Roe versus Wade is about abortion. Mm-hmm. So as striking as that might seem to us, I mean, that's the reality. So people who identify as pro-choice, identify as pro-life, most people just haven't really thought through these issues carefully. And once they do, my experience is they are much more open, because I think especially if they're pro-choice, they think of pro-lifers as being sort of like unthinking, not having very good arguments, being super conservative and closed-minded. And once they see that we're not, I mean, I'm biased, of course, but I think, frankly, the arguments work better on our side.
That article you were talking about, I really appreciated it, and I actually pulled it up. It's seven reasons it is deeply misleading to claim more Americans support Roe v. Wade, and that's definitely necessary as we lead up to the confirmation hearings for Kavanaugh, because like you said, a lot of people, when they're discussing Roe, they kind of, I feel like they just kind of default to the side that they're closest to, like Republicans. Well, yeah, I'm pro-life, but well, can you explain why you're pro-life? Well, not really, but you know, I'm pro-life, and that doesn't exactly help our cause. And kind of the same on the other side. Well, I'm pro-choice because, you know, it's a woman's rights. Well, what about the child? Well, you're, you know, trying to oppress me. Well, that's not exactly correct either. So this article that you wrote, I really, like I said, appreciated. And one of the things in there that kind of struck me was number four, you have Americans support abortion restrictions that Roe banned. And it's interesting to me, like I said, when people first talk about abortion, they think, you know, because they're the closest to one certain political side that they are defaulted towards that side. But most Americans are pretty specifically against late-term abortions, I would say. Aren't they, most of them, just pretty supportive of first trimester abortions, which it's not as if that is better because it's still a human life. It doesn't look so much like a baby as it does in the second and third trimester. But most are against abortion after that. Is that correct?
Yeah. So Gallup just a couple months ago or even a few weeks ago just came out with a poll, which once again found, and they've found this for years, that before 12 weeks in the first trimester, Americans, about 60% or 6 in 10, largely support abortion rights. Though it's interesting, if you ask about specific examples of abortion in the first trimester, you get very different kinds of answers. So if it's for the mother's life being in danger, as you might imagine, there's quite a lot of support for something like that. But if it's abortion for the in the case of just any reason, it drops to 45% in the first trimester, less than half, which is, I think, very interesting. And if you ask about Down syndrome, there's even an interesting difference between men and women for first trimester abortions because of Down syndrome. Only 44% of women thought that abortions should be legal compared to 56% of men, which is interesting as well because we tend to think of women being the most important defenders of the so-called right to choose and men being the ones that want to impose their views. It's actually quite the opposite. If you actually look at specific kinds of abortion, something also something similar is true of the abortion ban after 20 weeks, the Pain Capable Act. 60% of women support that while only 50% of men support a ban after 20 weeks. So yes, all these restrictions would be illegal, are in fact illegal under Roe and its successor case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And so when we say Americans support Roe versus Wade, it's not even clear they even know what they're saying when they say Roe versus Wade, because if you ask them about specific kinds of abortion, they say, oh, we should ban that one. But then Roe wouldn't allow them to ban that. So it's we need to drill down a little bit more carefully, and I think we should all just be skeptical of any poll that asks about things like Roe or pro-life versus pro-choice. These things are not helpful. What's helpful is actually asking about specific kinds of abortion.
Yeah, it's also interesting that, you know, if you are talking about Down syndrome, and Down syndrome isn't detected other than by a marker test, you can only, you know, get you can only get that actual result from an amniocentesis, which also increases your likelihood of, you know, spontaneously aborting, which is miscarrying. And, you know, what they have found is that those marker tests aren't always that accurate for Down syndrome.
Yeah.
Healthy babies, I'm sure, have been aborted because the parents thought they were going to have Down syndrome. Going back to the Stupak Amendment and abortion being kind of like underwritten with Planned Parenthood, where does like Democrats for Life stand on things like those kinds of issues where Planned Parenthood is, you know, gets so many dollars for not for abortion, but for, you know, other types of services that they, you know, I mean, there's studies on how much they actually perform these other, you know, things like mammograms and stuff like that, but they're also able to, you know, make.
Well, they don't perform mammograms.
Right.
They don't have. Right.
But that's what
Cecile
they say.
Tried to pull that, but it's not true.
Zero mammograms. Zero.
Yeah.
Mammograms.
So, well, but yeah, they try to say that they're doing these things, but clearly, you know, the the caveat to that is always, well, you're getting federal dollars, so you're able to make your abortions cheaper. So where does Democrats for Life, I guess, rest on those types of issues that are so kind of like beloved to, and like you said, you know, you have a hard time, you know, being a member of registered member of a party that kind of stands that way. But how would you say that you could kind of changes? I mean, we couldn't even get a 20-week abortion ban passed, even with people right. like, you know, at least, who's the chick from Maine? I can't think of her name right now. It's not
Susan Collins.
Yes, sorry, I was thinking Olympia Snow. I'm like back in like 2006.
basically the same.
Yes, person. It is. Yeah. So. I've lost my like real pointed question on this, but just where do you see like the future of legislation on this?
Well, you originally started talking about Planned Parenthood, and if I can just be totally clear, Democrats for Life is anti-Planned Parenthood.
Okay. That's...
So there's no pro-life case for Planned Parenthood. They make a huge portion of their revenue from abortions. Almost every other service has lowered in frequency, and abortion has gone up consistently, and Planned Parenthood has increased the market share, their market share with abortions dramatically. I did an op-ed for the New York Daily News recently, which expressed some frustration that we've had with the Colorado Planned Parenthood trying to kill the union of its union in Colorado. And we're obviously pro-union because we're Democrats. And we think this is horrible that a organization that claims to be on the Democratic side of things would be engaged in union busting, which is what it has. And it's not just in Colorado. It's done at many other places. So this is a very interesting thing to highlight. Who should run the Democratic Party? About 20 years ago or so, we probably would have said Labor should run the Democratic Party. That's what's most important. But now it's Planned Parenthood, and Planned Parenthood is not only not supporting Labor, it's actively against Labor. It's actually actively against unions. So that's another reason we don't support Planned Parenthood. They're not even really Democrats. They have their own interests in mind. And that money is fungible, as everybody knows. One of my favorite people in the pro-life movement is Abby Johnson, and she used to run a Planned Parenthood clinic. And she will tell anybody, like, we didn't separate the money; it's all fungible. So we got reimbursed from Medicaid, you know, and it all went into the same pot. So it's just a lie to say that. It's just totally misleading to say that we can separate this money. It's just a convenient fiction we tell ourselves. And as long as Planned Parenthood has the kind of influence it does, which, again, they're one of the main leaders pushing Shout My Abortion, you know, no more pro-choice. Instead, we're going to talk about abortion care, one of the most offensive, I think, phrases we could ever come up with, abortion care. As long as that's the direction we're going in, and they're, frankly, and you two might disagree with me about this, but as long as they're going to push anti-labor policies, the states that Democrats have to win, like Wisconsin, like Michigan, like Ohio, like Pennsylvania, they're just not going to win those states. They're totally against shout my abortion approaches to abortion. Even mildly pro-choice people there are offended by that. And then obviously if you got, you know, anti-labor practices by the group that's running the Democratic Party, you know, it's going to happen again. For those of us that would like to see Donald Trump to lose, if this is the way that the party is going, we're going to get six more years of this guy. There's no question of that.
I would say one of my biggest questions for you has to do with how the Democrats for Life can combine with other pro-life organizations and movements that are kind of on the right side of the aisle. In June, I was able to go to the Pro-Life Women's Conference in St. Louis, which is their third annual one, and I actually met Abby Johnson. It was so wonderful to talk to her. And at the conference, there's different booths set up. There's LGBT for Life. There's a Democrats for Life table. There's secular pro-life. And it was refreshing to see at a conference that wasn't specific to one political party, kind of this uniting behind a cause. Yeah. But as far as Democrats for Life, I actually had never heard of them until I went to the conference, the pro-life conference for women last year for the first time, and I saw the Democrats for Life table, and I was like, I'm, who are you? I don't even know what you, like.
We know you fell off your high heels, Kim. We know you fell off your high heels.
I was like, are you at the, like, is this the right conference for you? Because I'm not so sure if it is. So my question is, how can Democrats for Life and the bigger pro-life organizations like National Right to Life and others, Live Action and Abby Johnson's, and Then There Were None, how can they work together to promote the same cause? Because as of right now, it seems as if they're very, very separate.
Yeah. Boy, that's really maybe, for my money anyway, the most important question we could ask, because we have to be united to resist the kind of power and money and resources that we're up against. And it's not easy. And, you know, I think, I don't know if this is a helpful thing, but it comes from economics, or at least ostensibly from economics. If we think about attacking the problem from both the supply and demand side, could we find some common ground if we all agree to do both rather than one or the other? So Democrats, pro-life liberals sometimes get criticized for not caring at all about actually protecting babies with the law. Like, we only want to pass, you know, supposedly, you know, handouts or, you know, giveaways or whatever, social programs. And it's true. We want paid family leave. We want help with childcare. We think these things are really important for saving babies' lives, because I think we've seen in other countries lower abortion rates happen when you support women with these kinds of programs. But that's not all that we need to do. I think if we had basically the abortion rate of most of Europe, we'd have about 700,000 abortions instead of 1 million. So that's still Holocaust. So we need to do more than that. We need to push as hard as we can to get prenatal children equal protection of the law. But where I see the divide is we kind of like split over what side of that we kind of fall on and what we focus on. And maybe we disparage, or not we meaning us three, but in general, maybe people tend to disparage the quote other side for doing only what they do. Maybe one uniting, plan might be, let's just try to save babies' lives from both the supply side and the demand side.
One of the things I really appreciate about you in the past few weeks is that you have a very, very consistent pro-life ethic, which of course is in the womb and then all the way up until natural death. And I know, like this week, the Pope was talking about how the death penalty, essentially saying that that's not something that Catholics should support, of course. But aside from that, you, in the past few weeks, I think it was in June, in mid-June, you wrote a piece for the New York Times, an opinion piece, which, as for someone who's on the right, it was a very controversial kind of topic and issue that was happening at the time, it's still ongoing, I should say, in terms of immigrant children and being separated from their families at the border. And you wrote the piece, "You Can't Be Pro-Life and Against Immigrant Children." And I shared that on social media, and of course, plenty of people did not agree with me. And they definitely thought that it wasn't a pro-life issue, but I believe it is. Can you maybe expand a little bit on your position behind, you know, being consistently pro-life from birth to death, and why that topic is also a pro-life issue?
Well, my talk at the Democrats for Life Congress conference we just had was on why a consistent ethic of life can't be Calvin ball. And I date myself, I think, by talking about Calvin and Hobbes, the cartoon. I don't even know if you even know what that is. But
oh, yes, love it.
The problem with being a professor is you get older, your students stay the same age, and you lose the ability to make these cultural references.
We may be millennials, but we're older millennials.
We're elderly. We're very elderly millennials. Yes.
Thank you. So you might remember Calvin Ball is the game that Calvin and Hobbes play, where there's no rules and you just make it up completely as you go. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a lot of people who criticize the consistent ethic think it's like. It's like, well, anything can be a consistent ethic of life issue, right? But that can't be right. I would reject something like that. I'm currently working on a book on Pope Francis's understanding of the throwaway culture as being a way to kind of unite all these different sets of issues under one image, the use and throwaway culture. And I think has dramatic impact or dramatic import for the situation at the border. Like, we literally took children and separated from their parents, we intentionally caused them pain and suffering apart from their parents as a deterrent to undocumented immigration, illegal immigration. Now, if we are serious about the fact that children are not things and ought not to be used as things, as they are so often in abortion. We have to be consistent in that. Children are not to be used as mere things. So if we're, even if one thinks it's a good outcome that there would be a deterrent effect and undocumented immigrants would be turned away because they heard that parents and children would be separated at the border, that's still not right. It's not, we're not utilitarians, presumably. We believe children have rights, and children have the right not to be torn away from their parents just because we think that a good outcome might come from that. Another example of why it's a pro-life issue is related to our deportation practices. So we, I think, as part of this process, changed how we viewed asylum claims so that we made it more difficult for people to claim asylum, even if they were threatened with violence. So we were sending people back, denying their asylum claims that we used to accept, and then subjecting them to terrible violence when they went back, quote unquote, home. One of my favorite bishops, Bishop Flores of Brownsville, Texas, who's right on Brownsville's right on the Texas-Mexico border. He somewhat provocatively analogized this to driving someone to an abortion clinic. You're not directly killing them, of course, but you're driving them to a place where violence is incredibly likely to happen. And that's not acceptable from a pro-life perspective. And so I think this is one of the things we pro-lifers, I'm biased, of course, but I think we need to kind of disconnect from right-left politics and focus more again on applying our principles consistently, because it's our lack of consistency, it seems to me, and not only our lack of consistency, but the lack of consistency in applying our principles in general that leads to injustice. And we can do a better job in this regard, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, just as a kind of a wrapping up kind of question, you know, it's like Kim and I are conservatives. We're kind of, you know, we come from the side that's like, you know, like, oh, well, our platform is pro-life and yours is, you know, murdering children or, you know, things like that. You know, but we also, you know, we have things on our own side that, you know, Barry Weiss, I watched, she did a speech last week. It was a very good speech. It was like almost an hour long, but Barry Weiss is pro-choice. You know, we have the same issues on our side. What can, like, people, you know, pro-life people on, you know, whether they're Democrats, independent, or Republicans, like, how do you suggest for people who are listening that are pro-life? And maybe, like, I would definitely say, like, I get a little bit, you know, caustic and probably bigoted towards people. And I, you know, it's like, I don't try to use bigoted as like a bad term. Like I try to use words very literally, and it's not always necessarily a bad word. It's just recognizing that you have your own biases and things like that.
We all are biased.
Yes.
Yeah, we're all biased.
So just like, how do you normally like tell people when you're, you know, talking to people about, oh, well, you know, this is how we can be more inclusive. Like how do you, you know, suggest to people when they're talking to, you know, I mean, I guess it's to be more understanding and more, you know, kind and things like that. But how would you suggest, like, more, you know, trying to engender a good, you know, dialogue between people to have this kind of banner of like, hey, we might disagree on how we get to a place, but life is the most important thing that we should all care about.
I mean, it's, you catch more bees with honey, right? Are we interested in making converts? Are we interested in changing people's minds? Or are we interested in, you know, owning the libs or, you know, flaming people online or whatever it is that we're doing? Like, if we're interested in actually making converts and actually presumably saving people's lives and babies' lives and supporting women in part so they can choose life, then we, you know, the kinds of approaches that we'll take should show some evidence that we care about that. I'm not so sure that many people, some people clearly don't care about that. They care more about using it as a political wedge. This is one of my frustrations, frankly. I used to vote Republican just because that was the pro-life way to vote. And that was probably, you know, I voted for George W. Bush, his first term, only because of this issue. And I've changed my mind since then. And, you know, and I think it's just important to stay open-minded. Think about the best way to save the lives of babies and to support women. And if that's what we're focused on rather than, you know, our particular political agendas, then I think we're in good shape.
Yeah, I think a lot of people.
Go, Kim.
I'm sorry.
Go, Kim.
I was going to say, I think A lot of people tend to look at, and I am guilty of this too, tend to look at the big picture when it comes to the pro-life issue and message and everything. And really what it comes down to is working with within your community and with people who have needs right in front of you. The person on the internet, Debbie from Michigan, I'm not going to change her mind when I tell her she's wrong with her shout her abortion hashtag. I can help someone in my local community, a woman who needs supplies, someone to take care of her other children, just someone to talk to. And I think a lot of people tend to look at the big aspect of the pro-life movement when really it's a very, very much a grassroots kind of movement. And if we want to change it from a culture of death to a culture of life, it is not going to be a trickle-down approach. It's definitely going to be a trickle-up. And I mean, at least that's my point of view.
And that sounds like a good conservative approach to me, right? Like, why are we so focused on, we should be focused at least in part on law and especially federal law, but an exclusive focus on that. That seems more like, again, a democratic approach rather than a more conservative grassroots, let's get down to the people approach. So right. I think there's lots of common ground to be had.
Yeah, and Andrea, I'm sorry.
No, I'll just say this. I mean, as kind of a, you know, last little thing, not that it has anything. I'm going to talk about me, but you know, I was the college student that got pregnant accidentally, and I was never more grateful than to have the, you know, the, you know, Medicaid for and women, infants, children and stuff like that when I was that, you know, when I was young and single and pregnant. So, you know, it is kind of a dichotomy of, and maybe a cognitive dissonance where, you know, you're on a conservative side, but at the same time, like, I also want those services to be there and be to support, you know, some women that have are going through. And I'm definitely, it's like, I'm not just sympathetic, I am empathetic to the 100% degree of I understand where they're coming from and why this is happening. And I couldn't imagine if I hadn't had that system set in place. So,
Andrea, you're not careful, you're going to become a pro-life independent. I don't want to.
No, see,
she's still heavy into the GOP camp.
I'm not
and
heavy
as for
into
me,
the
I
GOP.
Went third party, and Andrea can't handle that.
I did not vote for Trump or any. I vote, but I.
You voted for Trump.
I did not vote for Kimberly. I cannot believe you. No, I always say the reason I am still a registered member of the Republican Party is because I am against open primaries, and I don't want you independents. So, everyone knows this. It's a very narrow reason for why I'm still a member of the GOP. But I'm a member of the GOP in Washington State. Does it really matter?
Andrea, are you finding common ground with Charlie? I don't think so.
It's okay to disagree a little bit, just as long as everyone admits that I'm right about it. That's fine.
Yeah, no, trust me, it is very difficult. I like every once in a while kind of like, should I just get out now? But anyway, so I definitely, you know, I probably consider myself an independent, but I will still stay a registered Republican just because I have a primary, I have a primaries stance that I have to stay true to. Charlie, thank you so much for being here. Sorry, I got us off track, but at the end there.
Yes, thank you very much.
No, it was my pleasure. My pleasure.
All right.
And everyone go put on your Amazon list or order it now with 2-day shipping or even sooner than that. Get Beyond the Abortion Wars, A Way Forward for a New Generation. That is by Charlie, and you should go read it.
Yeah, I actually added it to my, I was like, when I was going through our show prep, I was just like, I was looking at Amazon and I was like, you know, reading the little excerpts and I was like, oh, this is getting added to my wish list. But I have a stack of books that's like 12 deep, you know, it's definitely on the list. But Charlie, where can everybody find you on social media?
Basically, a good place is Twitter, which it's just at C. Camosi, my first initial and last name.
Alrighty. So we will let Charlie go and talk to you later. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye now.
Well, I really enjoyed having Charlie on and in his perspective and just like getting to pick his brain. I probably had like a dozen more questions that were more like getting into philosophy and like political science type, you know, ideas, but he was great. What did you think?
No, it was Oh, so good to talk to, especially because a lot of people in the pro-life movement don't really think about that there's Democrats for Life out there. And like I said, I had not heard of them until 2 years ago and did not know that they have their own conference. He
I
was
don't
just
know
at
that
their
a lot of
conference recently.
Democrats know that that Democrats for
No,
Life exists.
exactly. And I'm sure there are plenty of people in the Democratic, maybe not plenty, but some who are pro-life and aren't quite sure what to do with their leaning towards life, but then also that they're registered Democrats. So,
So this week, our new food, our food feud. Say that 10 times fast. Food
food
feud
feud.
has continued apace on Twitter, where it was National Cheesecake Day, and
It
you are a
was.
hater.
I saw that trending and I was like, the people need to know that cheesecake is horrible. It is nothing but a pie with cheese in it.
See,
It's
and
not good.
it's.
You can drizzle it in chocolate or caramel or strawberries or butterscotch. You can even put candy pieces inside the cheesecake, and it's still just cheese. I don't like it.
See, and I will. You can give me a plain piece of New York cheesecake, and I will
Ugh.
enjoy the hell out of that. Just
Well,
you can put blue. Like I had a blackberry. It had a blackberry swirl in it. You know that was the cheesecake had like a thing of blackberry right through it. It was kind of marbled with blackberry sauce, and it was. Oh, that was like 2 weeks
Was
ago.
colored cheese. That's
No.
fantastic, Andrea. But no, when I actually when I said that on Twitter and said that something about when I go to the Cheesecake Factory, I get, tiramisu or I get something else. I usually get some chocolate sort of thing, whatever. But everyone is like, "Well, you've never had real cheesecake then if you're talking about the Cheesecake Factory." No, this was just my example. I've had real live cheesecake and it's still disgusting.
No,
So
but
you're not changing it.
I would probably disagree with people who say, "Oh, if you had cheesecake at the Cheesecake Factory, you haven't had real cheesecake." I'm sorry, but the Cheesecake Factory does have very good, like, New York cheesecake. You know, I mean, you can get it anywhere. I mean, I've had it at tons of places. Like, you know, my mom makes it homemade. You know, things like that. It's like, I would disagree that the Cheesecake Factory New York cheesecake isn't good. That's just untrue. So,
I mean,
not that you would
it's not
know,
good.
since you are a weirdo. But
Yes, I have weird foods.
not in, for those of you who follow us on Twitter, which we hope you do, you were on your last day. Congratulations, you are now no longer in office. You've started a new career, new life. You are now a
Yes.
mommy blogger.
I am, for those who probably most people didn't know, I had a real actual job in an office, and yesterday was my last day there, and I'm transitioning to a full-time blogging mama because I have a child. So that's what I'm going to do. So yes, yesterday was my last day at work, and since there was not much to do, I of course went on Facebook and I found a quiz about which Bennet sister are you? And Bennet meaning the Bennet family from Pride and Prejudice. I had to instantly tell Andrea that there is that quiz out there. And we both took it.
Yes.
And Andrea, do you want to continue?
Well, I mean, you were telling me that you were more excited than you should be because you got Elizabeth Bennet as the result, which
I
who
got Elizabeth.
because Elizabeth is the main heroine of the Pride and Prejudice book novel. And so, you know, she's very opinionated. She's the Pride and Prejudice side of Pride and Prejudice. If you don't know that book,
Yes.
if you don't know that book, the Pride and Prejudice, people always say, "Well, who's prideful and who's prejudiced?" They both are. Both
The
Mr.
answer is
Darcy.
yes.
Yes. They both are. They
But
both.
she's confrontational too, and we've
Yes.
talked about this that I'm kind of more of an introvert in like social settings and stuff, but if I have to confront someone, I have no problem doing it,
You
which
and
is
that.
probably not like the best thing to have,
And I'm exactly the opposite. I'm very outgoing and very sociable. And not that you aren't sociable, but very social, socially oriented. Yes. But I will avoid confrontation at any cost. You know, and
Oh, send it my way. I love it.
I am very much like, no, but see, that's the thing though, is that I think I'm kind of like, I will like roll with it, but then I will also like try my best to get back at you in some, not in a horrible way, but just kind of. But here's the thing. So I got, and you called this. You were like, I got Elizabeth. I was like, oh, I need to go take it. And you're like, whatever. You're Jane. And I took two. I took the BuzzFeed one and I took the How Stuff Works one, which I will, if anybody who cares, even guys, you want to go take this test, find out which Bennett sister you are, go for it.
Yes.
But I took a longer one and a short form one, and both times came out with Jane, the oldest sister. And
see, that matches you completely.
Well, you know,
because you're not older than me. I think I'm older than you by a little bit, but you're, you know, educated, you're intelligent, but you're sweeter than Elizabeth and you're sweeter than me, and you're not a confrontational person like me. You're so Jane. You're Jane.
Now, our coworker, Joe Cunningham, Joe, I hope he listens. I might make him listen to this part. Joe, you are so, yeah. Joe at first said that I was Lydia, and then he corrected himself. And I got a little bit, I was like, Joe doesn't know what he's talking about. Lydia is this flighty little boy crazy hoe who ends up, you know, running off and getting married to a guy who doesn't want to marry her.
The worst person. Right.
And then he corrected himself and said, no, you're not Lydia. Oh, sorry, you're not Lydia. You're Kitty, Catherine, the second youngest. But which is worse, she's Lydia's little tag along.
She's actually more immature than Lydia, which is it's hard to beat Lydia, but she is. She's worse than that.
Yeah, no, what's funny is that Jane Austen later said someone asked, like, well, what happened to Kitty? And apparently Jane Austen always joked that Kitty married a clergyman. But that's the thing. I was like, so you're saying I'm like, Kitty's worse. Yeah. But the thing that I realized was that one of the questions was, do you want your ideal mate, like all these different things? And of course there was, you know, all the ones, and of course I have listened to this book on audiobook for every night for probably, you know, I mean, I go through phases between different ones, but I probably over a decade, and I've read it front to back probably a dozen times at least. So, I mean, I know these characters very well. So it's like, you can tell who they're talking about by what they're saying. And I kind of realized, I was like, you know, it would bother me. It bothers me when my fiance is like ever kind of like indifferent or kind of like not talkative, or, you know, that drives me absolutely crazy. Like I do kind of like someone that's a little bit more like Mr. Bingley, who's very kind of outgoing and talks to people and also, you know, just doesn't really hide like how he feels and stuff. Like, I was just like, and then the other thing that I realized when taking this test, and I'm sorry, I'm like commandeering this conversation, but I thought about it more. I was being more.
It's okay, Lizzie. Reflective. It's fine. You're totally fine.
But it talked about what would you do if your man who you knew liked you suddenly up and left. And then it gave you a bunch of options like, oh, I wouldn't care, or what's his deal? And then one of them was, I'd go to the town wherever he is and wait for him to contact me. And that is what Jane does. Okay, it's a little bit crazy that Jane goes off to her aunt and uncle's house to London to basically be in close, and the whole idea behind it is getting her in proximity of Mr. Bingley again.
Yes. Yes. Was that the BuzzFeed quiz?
I don't know if it was or if it was the How Stuff Works one. I think it was the BuzzFeed one was very short. The How Stuff Works one was kind of like, it was almost like annoying how long it was. It was like 36 questions or something like that. But I got Jane on both ones. So it's like, it wasn't. Anyways,
I'm pretty happy with my Lizzie.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, you should be, because Lizzie is beautiful as well, and she's intelligent, but she's, you know, as her father
says, she likes to argue more.
Well, as her father says, there's something that Lizzie has, something more of a quickness to her. So, and I would definitely say that you are like, even on social media, like I will not get into argument. Like I just, if I see somebody like being rude to me, I automatically mute them. You know, it's like, but you are like, I see your Twitter feed all the time, and it's so confrontational, not confrontational rude, but just kind of like, you're very sassy and I am not.
I try.
Anyway, so it was a fun quiz. I'll link to it. It's a silly thing, but we had a good time with it, didn't we, Kim?
Yes, we sure did, for
Yes.
sure.
Alrighty, so that about wraps our show up. Kim, where can everybody find... Oh, we need on everyone to rate and review us.
Yes, you need to go to our iTunes and you need to subscribe to this wonderful show when you can get more talk about politics, possibly more quizzes, and definitely more food feud comments.
Yes.
Yes. And when you're there and subscribe, you need to rate the show. And when you do, please do 5 stars because that is our favorite number.
And I have to agree with you, Kim, when you said that peanut butter toast is greater than avocado toast just because of flavor alone. Yeah. You know, peanut butter, the way peanut butter melts on a piece of warm bread.
Oh, it's so perfect.
Oh, it is amazing. But I like avocado toast too, but you gotta.
Oh, yeah.
Avocado really doesn't have a flavor. So, I mean, it does, but it's very mild.
You have to add a bunch of stuff to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, alrighty. So, Kim, follow you at Social Keeks. Social Keeks is not Kimberly.
No, you can follow me on Twitter at Southern Keeks, KEKS. And you can find me at Red State and Washington Examiner.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at Andrea and Ruth and on Facebook at Andrea Ruth Page. And at redstate.com. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.